I am your noble, robotic, introducer, and this is the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Welcome to episode 2021.01.00. This podcast is being published on Sunday, January 31st, 2021. If you would like a copy of today's episode, download it for free at radio, the number 4. ALL.net. That's radio, the number 4. ALL.net. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Google Podcast, and Anchor.fm. You can reach out to your host if you have any questions at radio, the number 4. ALL.net and Anchor.fm. Today's presentation is entitled, A Question That Is Dividing America, Federalism or Anti-Federalism, Which One Do You Believe In? It is the first segment from a multi-part episode, which has been thematically titled, America's Next Step. Now, on with the episode.
Now,
the definition.
Hi, I'm John Green. This is Crash Course U.S. History, and today we're going to talk about the United States Constitution. And in doing so, we're going to explore how the American style of government became the envy of the entire world, so much so that everyone else copied us. What's that, Stan? We're not going to talk about other countries stealing our form of government because no other countries stole our form of government? That doesn't seem possible, Stan. No, Stan, not the Libertage. Cue the intro. So today we're going to learn why the green areas of not America didn't copy us. All right, so as Americans may dimly remember from history classes, the constitutional system we've been living under since 1788, the year of the first presidential election, was not the original American government. The first government set up by the Continental Congress was called the Articles of Confederation, and it was, in a word, bad. In two words, it was not good, which is why it only lasted 10 years. The problem with the Confederation is that it wasn't so much a framework for a national government as it was a firm league of friendship, which unfortunately only sounds like a team of Care Bear superheroes. The Articles set up a government that consisted of a one-house body of delegates, with each state having a single vote, who, acting collectively, could make decisions on certain issues that affected all the states. There was no president and no judiciary. You can try to tell me that John Hanson, the president of the Congress, was the first American president, but it's just not true. Any decision required 9 of the 13 congressional votes, which pretty much guaranteed that no decisions would ever be made. Ah, supermajorities, always so efficient. But besides the two-thirds requirement, the Congress was very limited in what it could actually do. The government could declare war, conduct foreign affairs, and make treaties. Basically, the stuff you need to do to go to war with England. It could coin money, but it couldn't collect taxes. That was left to the states. So if you needed money to, say, go to war with Britain, you had to ask the states politely. The articles could be amended, but that required a unanimous vote, so zero amendments were ever passed. The government was deliberately weak, which followed logically from Americans' fear of tyrannical governments taxing them and quartering soldiers in their houses and so on. But here's the thing, weak government is like non-alcoholic beer. It's useless. That said, the Articles government did accomplish a couple things. First, it won the war, so yay! Unless you were a slave or a Native American, in which case, you know, probable boo. Second, the government developed rules for dealing with one of the most persistent problems facing the new nation. Ohio, which was called the Northwest, presumably because it is north and west of Virginia. Getting control of the land meant taking it from the Indians who were living there, and the Articles government was empowered to make treaties, which it did. Crash Course World History fans will remember the Athenians telling the Melians that the strong do as they can and the weak suffer what they must, and the Americans definitely went to the Athenian school of treaty making. Through treaties signed at Fort Stanwix and Fort McIntosh, the Indians surrendered land north of the Ohio River. The biggest accomplishment of the Articles government was the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which set up a process to create 5 new states between the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. Two things to know about this. First, it acknowledged that American Indians had a claim to the land and that they had to be treated better if settlers wanted to avoid violence. And second, Stan, can I get the foreshadowing filter? Yes, perfect. the ordinance outlawed slavery in all five of the new states. Still, the Articles government was a complete disaster for exactly one reason. It could not collect taxes. Both the national government and the individual states had racked up massive debt to pay for the war, and their main source of revenue became tariffs, but because Congress couldn't impose them, states had to do it individually. And this made international trade a total nightmare, a fact worsened by the British being kind of cranky about us winning the war and therefore unwilling to trade with us. In 1786 and 1787, the problem got so bad in Massachusetts that farmers rose up and closed the courts to prevent them from foreclosing upon their debt-encumbered farm. This was called Shays' Rebellion, after Revolutionary War veteran and indebted farmer Daniel Shays. The uprising was quelled by the state militia, but for many, this was the sign that the Articles government, which couldn't deal with the crisis at all, had to go. But not for everyone. Thomas Jefferson, for instance, was a fan of Shays' Rebellion. A little rebellion now and then is a good thing. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Which is all fine and good, I mean, unless you're the bleeding patriots or tyrants. But to most elites, Shays' Rebellion showed that too much democratic liberty among the lower classes could threaten private property. Also, people who held government bonds were nervous because without tax revenue, they were unlikely to get paid back. And when rich people feel like something has to be done, something is usually done. Let's go to the thought bubble. The first attempt to do something was a meeting in Annapolis in 1786 aimed at better regulating international trade. Only six states sent delegates, but they agreed to meet the next year in Philadelphia to revise the Articles of Confederation. The delegates who met in Philly the next year had a funny definition of revision, though. Rather than make tweaks to the articles, they wrote a new charter of government, the Constitution, which is, with some significant alterations, the same one that Americans live under and argue about today. Despite what some seem to believe, the 55 men who met in Philadelphia and hammered out a new form of government were not gods, but they were far from ordinary, especially for the time. Most were wealthy, some very much so. More than half had college educations, which was super rare since 0.001% of Americans attended college at the time. About 40% had served in the army during the war. But one thing they all shared was a desire for a stronger national government. The delegates agreed on many things. The government should have executive, legislative, and judicial branches, and should be Republican with representatives rather than direct democracy. But the devil appeared in the details. Alexander Hamilton, probably the biggest proponent of very strong government, wanted the president and Senate to serve life terms, for example. That idea went nowhere because the overarching concern of almost all the delegates was to create a government that would protect against both tyranny by the government itself and tyranny by the people. They didn't want too much government, but they also didn't want too much democracy, which is why our presidents are still technically elected not directly by regular people, but by 538 members of the Electoral College. This system is so Byzantine and strange that when American politicians speak of spreading democracy through the world, they never actually advocate for American-style elections. Thanks, thought bubble. So conflicts between competing interests arose quickly at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, the first being between states with big populations and those with small populations. Large states supported James Madison's Virginia plan, which called for a two-house legislature with representation in both proportional to a state's population. And smaller states, fearing that the big boys would dominate, rallied behind the New Jersey plan. New Jersey. This called for a single legislative house with equal representation for each state, as with the Articles of Confederation. But of course, coming from New Jersey, it had no chance of succeeding, and sure enough, it didn't. Instead, we got the Great Compromise, brokered by Connecticut's Roger Sherman, which gave us two houses. A House of Representatives with representation proportional to each state's population, and a Senate with two members from each state. House members, also called congressmen, served two-year terms, while senators served six-year terms, with one-third of them being up for election in every two-year cycle. The House was designed to be responsive to the people, while the Senate was created to never pass anything, and it was so masterfully designed that it still works to this day. However, this solution created another problem. Who should be counted in terms of representation? Slaveholding states wanted slaves to count toward their population, even though, of course, they could not vote because they were property. States with few slaves argued that slaves shouldn't be counted as people because, just to be clear, none of these dudes were not racist. This issue was solved with the notorious Three-Fifths Compromise. For the purpose of determining the population, the total number of white people plus three-fifths the population of other persons, the word slave was never used, would be the basis for the calculation.
So, yeah, that's still in the Constitution.
The Constitution also contains a fugitive slave clause requiring any escaped slave to be returned to their master. And this meant that a slave couldn't escape slavery by moving to a state where slavery was outlawed, which meant that on some level, some states couldn't enforce their own laws.
Spoiler alert, this becomes problematic.
But except for the tyranny of slavery, the framers really hated tyranny.
To avoid tyranny of the government, the Constitution embraced two principles, separation of powers and federalism.
The government was divided into three branches, legislative, executive, and judiciary, and the Constitution incorporated checks and balances. Each branch can check the power of the others.
The legislature can make laws, but the president can veto those laws.
The judiciary can declare laws void, too, but that's a power they had to grant themselves. You won't find it in the Constitution. I promise, you can look for it.
And federalism is the idea that governmental authority rests both in the national and the state governments.
As an American, I am a citizen both of the United States and of the state of Indiana.
And the national government, the one set up by the Constitution, is supposed to be limited in scope to certain enumerated powers.
Most other powers, especially the protection of health, safety, and morals, are left to the states.
But the Constitution also seeks to protect against the radicalism that too much democracy can bring.
The mostly rich framers worried that the people, many of whom were poor and indebted, might vote in Congress people or, God forbid, a president in favor of, like, redistribution of property.
To hedge against this, senators were elected by the states, usually by state legislatures, and they were supposed to be, like, leading citizen types.
You know, the kind of good Americans who take bribes and have adulterous affairs in airport bathrooms and patronize prostitutes and shoot Alexander Hamilton.
Anyway, the other hedge against too much democracy is the aforementioned Electoral College, which many Americans hate because it has the potential to elect a president who did not win the popular vote. But that's kind of the point.
The electors were supposed to be prominent, educated men of property who were better able to elect a president than, like, the rabble.
But the Constitution of the United States is a really impressive document, especially when you consider its longevity.
I mean, as Crash Course World History fans will remember, the nation-state is pretty new on the historical scene, and the United States established by the Constitution is actually one of the oldest ones.
But the Constitution would be meaningless if it hadn't been ratified, which it was, but not without a fight that helped clarify America's political ideology.
9 out of the 13 states were required to ratify the Constitution in special conventions called for the purpose.
In order to convince the delegates to vote for it, three of the framers, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, wrote a series of 85 essays that together are known as the Federalist Papers.
Taken together, they're a powerful and ultimately persuasive argument for why a strong national government is necessary and ultimately not a threat to people's liberty.
Oh, it's time for the mystery document?
The rules here are simple.
If I name the author of the mystery document, shock as in surprise. If I don't, shock as in...
All right, Stan, let's see what we got here.
If circumstances should at any time oblige the government to form an army of any magnitude, that army can never be formidable to the liberties of the people while there is a large body of citizens, little, if at all, inferior to them in discipline and the use of arms, who stand ready to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens. This appears to me the only substitute that can be devised for a standing army and the best possible security against it, if it should exist.
Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton. Yes!
Too easy, Stan, although I appreciate the opportunity for a rant.
The whole idea of the Second Amendment was that the people could protect themselves from a standing army by being equally well-armed.
Which these days would mean not that citizens should have the right to buy assault rifles, but that they should have the right to buy, like, unmanned drones.
And arguably suitcase nukes. And by the way, in the Constitution, this is not listed as a privilege, it is listed as a right.
And as a right, if I can't afford my own Predator drone, I guess the government should buy one for me.
It's almost as if Alexander Hamilton had no way of knowing that weaponry would one day advance past the musket.
P.S. You know how Alexander Hamilton died?
Gunshot!
Sorry, I had to.
I am on a roll.
So it would be easy to ignore the people who opposed the Constitution because, you know, they lost.
But some of the ideas of these so-called anti-federalists were particularly powerful and they deserve a bit of attention.
Anti-federalists, unlike the mostly wealthy federalists, were usually supported by common people, small farmers who weren't as involved in commercial activity.
They saw less need for a strong national government that would foster trade and protect creditors.
And the anti-federalists were very afraid of a strong government, especially one dominated by the wealthy.
Writers like James Winthrop held that a large group of United States would be like an empire and that no extensive empire can be governed upon republican principles.
As evidence, he could point to Britain, or all the way back to Rome.
Smaller, more local governments are more responsive to the people and better able to protect their rights. To the anti-federalists, that meant state governments.
And while ultimately the Federalists won out and the Constitution was ratified, the issue of how large government should be did not go away.
So the Constitution was really only a starting point. It's a vague document, and the details would be worked out in the political process, and then on the battlefield. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next week.
Crash Course is produced and directed by Stan Muller. Our script supervisor is Meredith Danko. The show is written by my high school history teacher, Raul Meyer, and myself, edited by Stan and Mark Olson. The associate producer is Danica Johnson, and our graphics team is Thought Bubble.
If you have questions about today's video or anything about American history, good news, there are historians in common, so ask away.
Thanks for watching Crash Course, and as we say in my hometown, don't forget to be awesome.
Class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no wars, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Brian D. Swamp, this Class 4 Battlefield Podcast. Second. I am starting to understand and realize the argument that has crippled this country. Is not progressivism or conservatism. I've talked to you about that. You need both in a society anyway. It's even to an extent, to a great extent, not even about, you know, Confederacy or non-Confederacy. Which, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, you may not understand this, but that is a legitimate argument that is left over from the post-Revolutionary War days. There was a conversation that was happening after and really during the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and then during the days of the war, then immediately after the war was won, which question what kind of country this would be. There were people who fell on two sides. You had the Republicanists who wanted the society, the country, to be organized like a republic. And you had the Confederates. The Confederates, I guess, is what you would call them. Who wanted the country to be organized like a confederacy. From those two camps, two further camps emerged. And I would argue today that these camps, these other two camps, which were always there, held greater sway over who fell into what camp. Either were you going to be for a confederacy or were you going to be for a republic? Were you going to be a republicanist or were you going to be a confederate? Those two camps, which we might call them, those two groups were widely viewed after people realized that the Confederacy wasn't working. Those two groups were called the Federalist and Anti-Federalist groups. Now today, you have right-wing billionaires who have completely upended the term federalist, which was for a federal government. And they have completely disavowed the notion that they are anti-federalist, even though they are anti-federalist. Their actions against the federal government say that they are anti-federalist. But even more interesting, because that is the argument, I don't care if you call them Democrats, I don't care if you call them Republicans, independents, the whole idea, how you have your, I'm starting to perceive that, what they really mean by left and right is to the left is more federal government intrusion, to the right is more state intrusion, less federal government. The furthest right you get, the less and less and less government that you, that federal government you have. The further left you get, the more federal government you have. This has been the common strain of all of the arguments for the last 200 years. Federalist versus anti-federalist. That's what the argument has been about. Now, admittedly, in the beginning of this country, the federal government was pretty weak. And it was designed that way. It was supposed to be pretty weak. The only institution that was given a lot of teeth were the judiciary. And even then, the judiciary wasn't that strong. Because it didn't have the legislative ability to enforce its rulings, especially across the country. With the movement away from the British Commonwealth system and the movement more vigorously towards a capitalist system, which was, you know, capitalism hit Britain as a industrial system back, what, in the late 1700s, the U.S. in the North started to reproduce what Europe was doing. What this resulted in was a boom for corporate power. Now, the corporate power in the North was still checked somewhat by the Southern feudalist system that was based on enslavement and peasantry. But power of the Northern financial institutions, the northern merchants, and other industry sectors, was undeniable. Now, it took a civil war and a restoration of enslavement in the South for corporations to really gain traction throughout the country. And it seems then, whether it was a deliberate decision or not, it seems then that the Republicanists, which, by the way, you know, I'm not talking here about party. I'm talking about people who subscribe to the idea that this should be a Republican-style country, which would have included many Republicans, party people, and many Democrats. But in the South, the Democrats were looked at as supporting the Confederate style. So many Southerners stayed with the Confederate. But it seems then that the Republicanists started working more closely with corporations, seeing, and the you know, this isn't, this wasn't accidental. They saw that corporations could actually help to build the Republican system in government and throughout society, which makes a lot of sense because the corporate structure, at least the early corporate structure, came from the Roman Empire, or excuse me, the Roman Republic. The idea of the fascist, not fascist, but the fascist, which was the bundle of sticks tied together by one stick, that comes from Rome. And I was listening to somebody speak on this a few months back, and as they said, you can actually find the fascists all over the place in Washington, D.C., because it used to be a powerful symbol, which a lot of people use to signify strength. But anyway, the Republicanists saw corporations as an instrument for building a republic. And the Democrats, still holding on to their idea of the Confederacy, the anti-federalists they were, distrusted power, particularly corporate power. They distrusted corporate power, and that was kind of where things stayed until the early 1900s, when people, particularly socialists, anarchists, communists, started pushing for this tremendous change. Now, because those three were pushing not only for a change in how corporations interacted with society, but was also pushing for a drastic change in the structure of society, the anti-federalists, as well as the federalists, had to take up a new charge. They had to reform their systems or risk losing both. That the argument would no longer be whether it would be an anti-federalist or a federalist structure, which still relied heavily on the ancient Roman Republic concepts. But the question would then be, what would come after it? And they didn't want that to happen. So they had to then take up the idea of reform. But no, even today, the idea of reform still boils down to the role of the federal government, the role of the state governments. It's still structured in a federalist, anti-federalist argument. So, as a push for reform started happening, to absolutely nobody's surprise, the spoiled corporations didn't like it and pushed back. And instead of saying, okay, maybe we've been a little heavy-handed, they said that, and, you know, reading Upton Sinclair's stuff, you know, you get this throughout many of his books. They painted the communists, the socialists, the anarchists as the bad people, and painted their need to exploit and pollute and destroy and abuse people. They paint what they were doing as humanistic and good, while all the time playing each side, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, against each other. Whichever one would give them the most power, they sided with. Now, in the South, they could have some power, but it was limited because the Confederates didn't trust a lot of the major corporations because they had been aligned with the Republicans and they had been aligned with the North. And the South remembered that. But throughout the North and the West, they ruled. And the Republicans allowed them to rule. Well, once the Great Depression came on, the argument that is very, very famous, which Roosevelt tried making to them, which was, look, you can lose it all, or you can reform dramatically. When you look at it from the standpoint, and I got to say, Matt Stoller's book, Goliath, really helped me see this. He helped me see all of this, especially with what people were talking about when they were saying words like socialist, because there was a deep federalist concept in the idea of socialist for many people. But that famous argument that FDR made
it explains a lot when you start looking at things as a Federalist, anti-Federalist argument. What FDR was essentially proposing was, let us legislate you into controlling yourselves, or you can allow them over there to literally come in and say, to hell with all of you, we're taking your industries. So we either can legislate you and control you so you stop doing these bad things, or you can let them literally come through and take your stuff away, and they ain't going to be controlling you, but they will be controlling your property. That's the choice. He was proposing a lighter federalism. He was proposing a lighter federalism to stop the radicals from doing much, 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 much more. What I guess he would have looked at as devious things to them. Now, I want to point out here that, you know, there's this quote that came out of, who was it? Was it Plutarch? Where I think it was Plutarch, but I can't be certain, where he was explaining, or it might have been a commentary on one of Plutarch's books. Anyway, they were explaining why Plutarch had set a very dramatic and revealing scene to one of his books in the house of like 6 or 7 Romans that were going to be dead within 5 years, even though they didn't know it, obviously. And they said, the commentary said that it was believed in the ancient times, and I believe this too, that as one nears their expiration date, as one nears the time when they will no longer be on this planet, that they see clearer. And sometimes that encourages them to do much better and to call for things which just 4 or 5 years earlier would have seemed absolutely ridiculous. And I believe that FDR, in the waning years of his life, began to have such moments of clarity. His second Bill of Rights, I think, underscores what he saw as not having, as him, he saw to an extent what would become of the New Deal. He may have peered into the future and saw what we are going through and what we have been going through. He recognized that only through the subsidization of the basic needs of life by the government, by the federal government, would it stop corporations from depriving people of those basic needs. And the only reason I believe that is because what he proposed in that second Bill of Rights compared to what he had been saying in the 30s, that tells me that he saw it. He saw the need for it. And the fact that he was, I think, if I remember correctly, dead within a year of making that statement tells me that that was what he saw as preventing some of the problems coming up in the future. Of course, it didn't happen. But the argument about federalism and anti-federalism started almost immediately after the war ended, as there was a major general strike. Paul Jay talked about this a couple of years back. There was a major general strike in 46, and within a couple of years of that, there was, the Taft-Hartley Act or whatever that gave corporations the right to hire and fire people at will. And then, you know, the whole right to work state thing, which, yeah, please, right to work, right to fire, that's what it is. Or right to work to death, that's what it is. But you saw after the passing of the Taft-Hartley, which, you know, I'm surprised, nobody has ever made these connections. Or at least I haven't seen any books that have made these connections. But there seemed to be a stout plan that corporations were implementing after World War II ended. And particularly, possibly even after the major, that general strike. Because soon after Taft-Hartley, you had the ramping up of the whole McCarthy thing. And obviously, look, you had other things that happened between them, but you had the ramping up of the McCarthy thing. And what that did was people who would have helped to organize that 1946-1947 general strike, those people mostly would have been communist, socialist, anarchists. You also had, well, what it would have done was, you know, it would have started severing the ties of those people to the communities which they were helping. You also had, in the late 40s, into the early and mid-50s, a advertisement blitz across the country, revisioning history. I watched this like 15-minute video back in 2017. YouTube's been taking a lot of this stuff down, by the way, which is kind of interesting. It was from an archive, and it was a legitimate archive, so I'm surprised, but I wasn't able to find it a year ago when I was looking for it. It was like this 15-minute video. It was basically a cartoon, and it was explaining how the economy worked. And how, you know, small people charging and big people trying to overcharge, how those two things conflicted, and how, you know, the big person would be driven out of business because he was gouging people, and the small person would prosper because he wasn't, and yada, yada, yada. And it was fanciful. But even worse, there was another video which I watched, which... And actually, this was the one that I meant to refer to. I flipped him. I'm sorry, y'all. This was the original one that revised the history. They literally said in this video that corporations during the Depression decided to push wages up, decided to do various things that, no, they didn't. There's actually legislation that did those things. But this video proposed that a lot of the changes which FDR fought for came from corporations. And this was in, I think the video was from like 51. So this was soon after, 6 years after World War II ended, they were already revising history and changing it. Now, if you look at such revisions as a anti-federalist argument, What you see is that they were making an anti-federalist argument. And that anti-federalism fed a lot of the Milton Friedmans and Hayek and all the rest who looked at any federal intervention as problematic. They didn't look at the fact of how things were, how they used to be, you know, what prompted the changes, things like that. They just said, I don't want to believe that this is the reason why, so I'm writing against it. And as we now know, obviously, many of the times these people wanted to create their own reality, not deal with real reality. Now, pushing through into the 70s, you see the framing even becoming even more staunch with, yes, the problems that were happening, particularly with the intelligence agencies. A lot of people fail to admit those things, that a lot of the governmental problems wasn't with the president. I mean, the presidents were never perfect, and to act like they were is crazy, but wasn't with the president, wasn't with even the legislature. It was some of these post-World War II departments that had been made, which were causing issues, including the CIA, including the FBI, including the DIA, things like that, including the Pentagon. We don't talk about the fact that these were the issues within the government that were causing the problems. Now, it's interesting, conservatives today like to talk a lot about the Constitution. Those four departments that I just named, none of them are in the Constitution. None of them. All of this stuff obviously wouldn't be in the Constitution, and it's not problematic that they're not in the Constitution. But for such sprawling bureaucracies as the Pentagon, as the CIA, as the FBI, which is supposedly in the Justice Department, as the DIA, which is supposedly in the Pentagon / military intelligence apparatus. But these things there should have been major amendments to the Constitution proposed to make these things permanent. They shouldn't have just been able to be created through legislation. But they were. But seizing on those things, which these departments were doing against the American people, the argument could be made and was made that the problem was the federal government in and of itself. And then what slick anti-federalist salesmen did, and it was slick, got to give them credit for it, is they said, everyone is mad about Richard Nixon and Watergate. Everybody's mad about the FBI, the CIA, the DIA, and the stuff that they've been doing. Absolutely. Everyone, white folks especially, are dismayed at Negroes losing, you know, their minds and not accepting their place in society. Whites are pissed about busing and other things that the judiciary is calling for the society to do to render the problems of segregation and racism. Well, now we're going to fold corporate stuff in there. Everybody is ready to accept anti-federalism. So let's fold in corporate stuff that will help shift corporations, which were starting to really get pissed off at Democrats anyway, to help shift them to a position of being permanently aligned with Republicanists. And that's what happened. Now, I highly doubt that these people, most of them, understood that this is what was happening. But I found it interesting when I was really starting to get into conservatism back in 2010, 2011, and 2012. I kept hearing, and this is when conservatives used to be pretty lax, is the word that I want to use, where I could actually talk to my conservative friends, and a lot of them had just gone to college, had just graduated from college, was, you know, happy to spread the gospel of conservatism, and so I met a lot of people who were willing to talk, and what I found over and over and over again, other than them reading things like Hayek, a hack, von Mises, another hack, Milton Friedman, double hack, and you know, some other folks, including Bill Kristol, Deadface Kristol, and many other people. One of the things that they all had in common also was they had read the Anti-Federalist Papers. And I remember after like the third time that I had heard that, I'm like, wait a minute, did you read the Federalist Papers? No. Why not? Because it wasn't important. Okay. Sound familiar, right? Whether or not they were cognizant of it, they obviously knew about the anti-federalist concept. And I would argue that many of these people read it. And I want to say Dark Money, the book Dark Money actually talks about numerous people who having read the anti-federalist papers, but don't quote me on that. It might have been another book that I listened to at the end of last year. But they know that this exists. The question is, do you know it exists? We keep thinking it's about republicanism and democracy. The reality is, these are forms of society. Okay? People do not get this. You cannot have a democratic republic. Those are two different systems. They can't intertwine. Oh, but we vote. Yeah, you know nothing about the Roman Republic, do you? The Roman Republic used to have voting for its citizens. Note what I said, voting for its citizens. It had disenfranchised a whole lot of people underneath its jurisdiction. But the people who counted were the citizens. The argument that we're having today about voting rights and citizens and stuff like that, understand, this ain't new in West Eurasian politics. Democracy was supposedly what the Greeks had. I would argue more blatantly that democracy was what the Iroquois had. And the Greeks, living in a hostile environment, could never sustain what the Iroquois had because the Iroquois had peace and the Greeks did not. Moreover, the Romans wouldn't let democracy really flourish because they knew that they themselves were incapable of reproducing it. So they would work to sabotage it anywhere that it was at. Sound familiar? Sound familiar? Now, those are two different those are two different systems, y'all. Democracy versus republicanism. Therefore, the argument when you're talking about democracy, when you're talking about republicanism, the argument can't just be on them too. We are having a discussion today, not about democracy versus republicanism. Most Americans, particularly white Americans, I don't care if you count yourselves as progressives or whatever, you want a Republican style government. As Mark Bly said, it's the only one that works because he can only think in terms of capitalism, which I get that. It's the only one that works. There is no alternative, as Margaret Thatcher once said. So, though the argument isn't between the two systems anymore. Communism, anarchism, socialism actually wanted democracy. And that's what I'm recognizing. Now, how it was framed in the United States, really, it only seemed like anarchism and social and communism seemed to be leaning heavily towards democracy. Socialism leaned towards a Republican style. And there was many different branches of socialism back then, so there were some that don't fall into this. But a lot of the people leaned towards a Republican style of government, with the federal government serving as the chief planner for the entire society. That's a lot of the socialists did, not all of them, but a lot of them. Because of the fact that these are two different systems, though, we have to get away from looking at everything as those two systems. The arguments that are going on now break down to anti-federalism and federalism. That's what they break down to. Are we going to have more federal interference or less? And look, Fox News will admit that. Rush Limbaugh will admit it. Sean Hannity, all of these, they'll all admit it. They just will say that, oh, it's a Republican versus Democratic thing. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's federalism versus anti-federalism. The problem is, and this really is the problem, if you look at what happened when anti-federalism was allowed to reign, if you look at what happened, it destroyed itself. The Confederacy, the first Confederacy in the United States, was right after the United States gained its independence. It, I think, lasted for 10 years. It didn't even last for 10 years, if I remember correctly. It destroyed itself. The second one lasted less longer. And the reason why is because there are common problems throughout all 50 states which only a centralized collaborative body can take care of. And by the way, republicanism acknowledges this. Democracism acknowledges this. So there's no fighting. Moreover, anti-federalism doesn't say that you can't have a central body. The only thing that it says is that it can't be government. Anti-federalists are very good at forming NGOs that seem to act and function like governing bodies. NGOs, non-governmental organizations, guys. They are very good at doing that. In 1999 in Seattle, that huge conference, which a lot of people were talking about, was kind of like a New World Order planning session. Nobody quipped at the fact that that was essentially a government unto itself meeting. Nobody quipped about that. Nobody quipped about the fact that that was essentially a government unto itself meeting. And if you look at a place like ALEC, A-L-E-C, that is literally a wealthy man's legislative body, which then interacts with the, it's like it's a shadow government. I said to a friend of mine some time ago, and when he was talking about, you know, the shadow government and the deep state and things like that, and I laughed at him, and I said, you guys have no clue. I didn't say clue. I actually said no effing clue. What the hell are you talking about with this stuff? You're watching people who are telling you that this stuff exists. But they're not telling you actually where it exists. When Ronald Reagan, which, you know, supposedly Ronald Reagan didn't know, but when Iran-Contra was executed, it literally was a shadow government. It literally was a shadow government. But today, which, you know, that was just one, you know, example, but today, you have things like ALEC, which operates as a NGO, which controls, though. That NGO controls legislative priorities all across the country. You have NGOs whose main job it is to build talent to then go into government and ruin it. When you talk about the deep state, you're talking about a lot of wealthy people and their organizations. That's what you're talking about. And, you know, he was like, well, you know, how do you know that? And I'm like, yeah, I read books. I read books. You start reading enough of them, you start seeing patterns. But again, just to curve it back, y'all, it all falls into this anti-federalist federalist concept. And the sooner we acknowledge this, and the sooner we accept it, so the sooner we can start pushing ahead in solving the problem. The question that I have is, can the problem be solved? I've been saying for a while that a lot of these conservatives are from a definitional standpoint. I don't give a darn about the philosophy, because philosophy doesn't even connect to the definition of the word. They're nihilists. Conservatives are nihilists. Many of these people are nihilists. Well, if you look at them through the lens of anti-federalists, ladies and gentlemen, they are nihilists. Their job, what they look at as their purpose, is to go in and destroy the federal government. That is literally nihilism. That's literally a nihilistic agenda. They want to destroy it. They want to destroy it. They are destroyers. And that's what they do. Now, the question that has plagued me for some time is, what is the deeper motive? And here I'm not talking about the agenda to bring corporations up or anything like that. I want to know, what is the psychological reason for it? Because as a person who believes in reincarnation, as a person whose family is connected to Africa and connected to indigenous groups over here in this country, you can tell when there is something deeper within the genetic memories happening. And I'm no different. I see it. So I wonder what's propelling these people forward to do this, because there is something animating them, and it's not just ideology. But I suppose that'll have to wait till another time. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I'm your brother, Ryan Mayer. Deez. Till the next one. Peace. Hello, ladies and... Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about that. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Ryan Mayer. Deez. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And